This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Patricia Gray, author of a brand new book, Rupture, by Red Hen Press. And here she is.
This poem is called Blessing, and it's about a great, 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 great grandfather whose name I don't know, but whose story I've heard. Here's the way it goes. In from the field at noon, grandfather was obliged to put on a suit coat to come to grandmother's table. He'd sweat rivulets receiving the green beans and corn, iced tea, thy bounty, Lord. When he stood up, coat soiled, she'd turn away. A marrow of demand in those perfect cheekbones. Then, back with the applesauce cake, she'd pause by his chair, a hint of spice about her.
That's Patricia Gray. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and it was a book we're talking about that's brand new, entitled Rupture. What's the name of that poem?
Blessing.
Do you know what I love about that poem?
What's that?
It's sexy.
It is?
It's sexy. I mean, here is this woman. What is her power? This man is sweating. He comes in from the fields, we might imagine. He is in a coat to sit down to dinner in a country kitchen that might be in the, what, 1800s?
Yes, at least. It was way back.
And why is he so obedient? You don't give us any hints in the poem until she leans over him, and there's that wonderful line, a touch of spice. What is that line exactly?
A touch of spice about her. It's the applesauce cake.
Right. But it's also the attraction between them. Mm-hmm. And so I loved that poem when I read it. And I wondered how you knew about that.
Family stories. At family reunions, my family just tells stories.
Because you're from the South.
I guess so.
And but that's what people fun. Do.
And I'm always eager to hear them.
She's from near Charlottesville, Virginia. And she received her MFA from the University of Virginia. And this is what Billy Collins, former poet laureate of the United States, says about Patricia Gray. Passion, memory, fancy, desire, loss, all the notes of poetry are clearly audible in the poetry of Patricia Gray. To pick up this book is to hold the whole being of another. Let's hear another poem.
This is called Calf Born in Snow, and it is the poem that was picked up by Garrison Keillor immediately when this book came out. It begins, I can still hear the loud moan in my grandfather's kitchen, where the wood stove was open for the failing fire's warmth, and on the oven door, wrapped in an old quilt, lay the new Charolais calf. A twin that survived its snowy birth that morning, though its brother died. Both of them the color of muddy snow, this one too weak to stand. We tried to feed him his mother's milk, but he seemed to forget he was eating and slept. So that by 10 that night, when he raised his head suddenly, making a loud meh sound, I could scarcely believe it. He's getting better. Dad put his hand on my shoulder. Quiet. He's dying, was all he said. Old knowledge, deep as the blue mountains. Still, I'd witnessed that final wonderful rallying. As if every ounce of life pulled together to raise the calf's head, to leave his sound so indelibly there.
That's the voice of Pat Gray. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. As I read your book, Patricia, I say to myself, poetry is a journey. It is a journey. Each book is a journey. If yours is, what is it a journey through? What do you suppose?
Well, it's a journey through time, and it's a journey through events that lead to some kind of insight or honesty about my life.
Mm. And that direct experience has to be confronted and changed.
Right, uh-huh. We have these moments, I think, when it's possible to change. We get lifted out of the ordinary for a moment. And it's possible to see something we haven't seen and to take some action one way or another.
I like that idea of taking action, because the poet then is someone who is not helpless.
Right, uh-huh.
We can change our experience no matter what happens, because we have that wonderful ability to create legend, maybe. The truth would be too bare, right?
Often it is, but one thing I've learned about writing poetry is to go for an emotional truth, even though the facts of the situation may change to fit the poem, the art form you're making, but keep the emotional truth.
Oh, that's excellent. Let's hear some more emotional truths from Patricia Gray.
Okay, this poem is called Rich with Desire. And it's about that time that feels sort of naughty when you go back to your parents' house with your husband, your new husband, or your lover, and you end up sleeping together in the bed that you slept in when you were a child. Rich with desire. We wake in the room I grew up in, birds chirping summer outside. The child of our bodies, thrumming his delight, kicking small feet, waving flexed arms like wings, in the crib that was mine, just as this bed was mine, and still holds the shape of my girlish body, before the fevered intrusions of love. Hold me then, husband, in this protected place, rich with lust, as we turn and turn in the covers, trespassing through time.
A universal experience that no one has written about until now. And then, Patricia, what happens when your children come back with their husbands? You want to put them in double beds.
I know. I don't want to be there.
Patricia Gray taking us through the journey of her life, which brings up the question, how much do we say? How much do we put in a poem? William Matthews says everything. He says put everything in, and I think he means emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
But at what point is the censor there, or should the censor be there? Now, in that poem, there was a moment of intimacy which takes courage. Was that something you had to overcome?
It was, to some extent. To own up to what happened, you know, to first be aware of it, you know, and then to think about lying in that bed where I had lain as a child, you know, and here, and to have my now husband there with me. It was extraordinary. And also, there's a hint of naughtiness, you know. I was partially still that little girl.
Of course. In the same room. Mm-hmm. Did it have the same wallpaper?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
You know, David Galanter says that there's, within a poem, another poem. So perhaps the naughtiness in your poem is the kind of the center of it that we don't get on the first reading.
Right. I think that's right.
And I do think that's true about your poems. They stand up for several reading, as delicate as they are. They have levels, mm-hmm, and veils, which are very, very skillfully put down. I bet you threw away 500 poems to make up this book.
Well, you know, this one came easily, but some of them I do.
You mm-hmm know, some. We're at the Library of Congress, and that's Pat Gray, and she's going on.
The next poem is Miss Western Auto. And in this one, I try to find part of the discomfort I felt as a teenage girl, about 14, being in a beauty contest. So I do want to tell you about a camera that plays a part in this poem. It's a Revere camera, and it takes two exactly the same pictures. And those pictures are then mounted on a slide, and you can look at them through a 3D viewer. Turn the light on, and you can see a three-dimensional picture of yourself. So my uncle had one of these. The past jumps forward from inside the lit viewer when Dan shows me the 3D photo of Ellie and me in strapless gowns standing beside the fir tree in Grandmother's yard waiting for the field day parade. Our creamy shoulders and bright looks startle me. Dan says he could almost step into that picture, taken with my uncle's Revere camera, and walk between those girls frozen in time on the third Saturday in August as they wait for the float to carry them away. The white clapboard house is the same. Even the light in the yard is the right golden hue for boarding the float with my friend. As we ride into town, wave, throw candy to children, I am learning the power of beauty. At the temporary stage, guards from the junior order offer their arms, present us with blue-tinted carnations, which we pin on, and numbers we carry before us like fans. My uncles, so safe and protective, slip into the crowd, joining men who look us up and down like items at auction requiring a bid. What happened to my uncles? They've changed, a small voice in me cries as the program begins. Rivulets of sweat run down my temples and cleavage. Miss Western Auto, my banner says, and though it scratches, I like it, for it means I'm one of the chosen. Called back before the judges, I try to guess what they see. The winner is named, and suddenly the special attention is all gone. I become an awkward girl whose hair is too short and straight, whose legs are too long. Dan complains. We'll be late, so I put down the past to dress in red with strappy sandals and pumps, glittering earrings, today's look. Still, the aura of that day returns when a man jumps up and holds my chair. I wonder at the pageantry of it, the distance between men and women, the distance between viewer and viewed, the binocular nature of vision that allows our two eyes to see separately, but blend completely for depth.
Pat Gray, known as Patricia Gray, author of Rupture. Everybody thinks it's going to be Rapture. Don't they say that to you?
Yes, they do.
And they say, oh, I think somebody misspelled the title of that book. Right. But there is a poem which makes it very clear about Rupture. And harking back to that poem we just heard, Miss Western Auto, were all the girls competing to be Miss Western Auto?
No.
Each one had a different banner.
They were all sponsored by a little business in town.
And
so
Miss Western Auto did not win. But what did win? Do you remember?
I don't remember which, but the girl was not from our county.
Oh, darn. I hate it when those outlanders come in and take our banners. But that is just such a wonderful poem. Just for the sake of craft, I always said, I can tell a lot by the way a poet begins a poem. So how you began the story was not, I remember, but you start with a camera.
Right.
You start with vision. And you carry that and complete it at the end of the poem with something about a view.
The binocular nature of vision.
Yes, that's right. And so we start the poem a certain way with a dimension of experience, and we end with that unity, which I think is very, very well done.
It took a long time to find the ending for the poem.
I can believe that, because you really needed to lift it away from an anecdote. You just couldn't have, this is what happened, and this is the way it felt. So you really created another depth to it. I admire that poem very much.
Thanks.
I'm sorry you didn't win, Pat. I'll get you a banner. Really? What do you want to be? Miss what?
Well, I don't think I want to be in a beauty contest anymore.
But just think how many of us never got to a beauty contest. So that was really a Southern story. Patricia Gray is here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And we're finding out what makes her tick, but more importantly, what makes her poems tick? And they're really a little more complicated than they hear. They're so easy on the ear that we love to probe and go into them. Let's have another.
Okay. This one is in three parts. It's called Secrets at My Uncle's House. Part one. I learned from you the elegance of proof, complex math, and my own inadequacies. That imagination steals energy from the real world, and even memory, so tidy and selective, can be brutal in its sameness, from which the density of touch is vanished, from which completion is barred, as it is for the buck leaping at the fence, or the puzzle always being worked on your table. I have come here, Uncle, for my sanity, that it might stabilize like an object in your room, like the fox skull you found in a field and baked till the spiders ran out. If there is any wisdom, it must be in collections such as these, in the clutter of your nests and shells, in the gargoyle or geode that waits to be taken up and turned in the hand, as if some lesson were in it, a clue to the unfocused excitement it provokes. Or wisdom might grow from movement, from the circular sweep of your arm as you lean over the conch shell puzzle, searching for the shapes you must have, while I rest my cheek on the smooth leather chair that sits on the worn rug slightly off square, and gaze at the objects everywhere on ledges, mock-ups, old prints, open books. It is evening, and the curtains are open. At the window, your telescope slants toward the North Star, as if this house were a navigable craft, and you were to take her home.
Pat Gray, the reason why I love to listen to you read is because you literally visualize your imagery as you're saying it. You are not reading the words. You are looking at that fox's skull. And you, because of that, we absolutely can enter your consciousness. It's a mechanical quantum physics thing that when you image and you make a hologram of your thinking, by the way you tell the story, we can go in there. I mean, have you ever read a book to a kid and don't really read it? You just read the words a bit. They don't listen because you're not really creating the experience. So I love to hear you.
Well, as you know, poets need to read that way, I think. I've told poetry students to stand behind their poems, but what I mean by that is to be in them while you're reading.
And it's wonderful because that takes our ego out of it, and we can almost forget we're nervous because we are. It's the material that matters so much, and you make that matter. Patricia Gray is on her way. She is going cross-country now to read in many a nook and cranny, and she will be featured at the Southern Women Writers Conference in Georgia. She will be part of a presentation on autobiographical engagements with family history, and she will go all through the South talking to fiction and poetry classes at schools, bookstores, and on TV and radio. I didn't know the poetry was in demand.
I didn't either. But the state poetry societies are absolutely wonderful, and they are happy to have visitors come, and they'll set up readings. And one of the places I'm going, of course, is to a school where I'll teach fiction and writing to high school students.
And I need to read your fiction next, because I know that's a skill you have.
I do have, but I haven't written much lately.
Well, we teach it then.
We can still teach it.
Pat Gray, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. But it would be fine if we could, on some occasion, maybe at the Writer Center or some panel, have you speak to the network of poetry throughout the country, because I think poets have no knowledge of this. And it would be a great service for you to say, look what you can do. And I'm sure the state societies would be really grateful for that help. So let's talk about that later. We'll do something about that. You know, Grace Cavalieri, Pat Gray, together.
This poem is called Late in the Day. And in it is mentioned an Arrowbee, which is very much like a Frisbee, but it doesn't have a center. So it's really a plastic donut that you throw. It's about a holiday with one's family, with my family. We continue our grievances at dinner. The short one is teased, the thin one maligned. Rivalries rekindled, grown children disowned. The holiday meal nearly ended. We abandoned turkey bone and gristle, cranberry sauce sweet and bitter as blood, and surrender one by one to the children, urging us out to play Arabi. My ex-husband and son have gone to new families. Only my brother, sister, and children and the sturdy man I now love stand with me in the lengthening light to toss the plastic ring that rises as if to go over the sun, though it glides up in a slow loop only, and down, passing from hand to hand. The brother who has tormented me tosses carefully now, so that I will catch and throw to the child between us, or to my sister, who with her great bulk hoards all that she has lost, yet lumbers to catch the ring as the circle widens like a ripple or shrinks to hold something we've never known, how to be together without rancor, as if life could be just this easy. And the family we are given by birth or by choice is the right one for us, the only one. And this life, this one life, is enough.
If you were teaching that poem, how would you teach people to tell their story and use some sort of unifying principle? Would you use that game you were playing as an example? Is that something that you feel is a good template?
That's what started the poem, because it was a precious moment, or several precious moments, in the late afternoon sun after a big family dinner. And I wanted to somehow capture it, to let people know it wasn't just going out to play Araby with your relatives. I mean, there was a lot more than that. It was a much deeper occurrence for us. I'm not sure the rest of the folks felt that way, but I sure did.
I think you were the poet in the crowd. Anyway,
it's true.
There was a lot of resolutions happening during that moment. Mm-hmm. A lot came together. The person who was teased was actually catered to for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And as always, the language you use furthers the notion. I mean, harking back to Miss Western Auto, when you put words together like juxtaposition of we went to the float carrying us away, just think of that. Carrying, float, carries, floats. Mm-hmm. So you often do that, and I think it's unconscious. The in your uncle's house, the buck leaping. You always follow a word which is a further extension of that word. It's very interesting to me. And in this case, the cranberry sauce, bitter as blood, we get the tenor of what's really going on underneath the poem, which is a little bit of rancor.
There's always that there.
Thanksgivings are well known for that.
You have a great Thanksgiving poem that I admire.
Thank you. We get to the end of the poem, and for a moment we are at peace. That moment after dinner where people have come together, you've finished the tasks, and you achieve a tremendous amount of serenity. Will you read the last line again for us, please? The last two lines, I guess, actually.
This family we're given is the right one, the only one, and this life, this one life, is enough.
This is the voice of Patricia Gray. I am Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're back, and we're talking about Rupture, a new book. Patricia Gray has been with us before she starts a tour. Why do they call them whirlwind tours?
Because they're pretty fast.
And you don't get any rest?
Not much, no.
She's going to be going all through the South. When will it be? A month tour?
3 weeks.
Is this something you want to do?
You know, I have this book, and I feel like it's a child that I brought into the world, and I have a responsibility to it now. It's not exactly a natural thing for me to do, but I need to give it its best shot.
Have you ever written anything you wish somebody wouldn't read?
Oh, sure.
Me too. When I think, sure. We don't realize that when we send these letters out into the world, they may get read. I mean, I have some things out there. I say, oops. May I have that back, please?
Yeah.
So this is something you're proud of, though, and every page is a disclosure where you take your primordial self and dress it up
in legend and myth,
and you make it acceptable, your experience. You just make it much more delicious than life really is.
Oh, I don't know. I think that life really is delicious. It's just finding the deliciousness, you know, sorting through the difficulties and finding the deliciousness. And often, once you get through the difficulties, what's on the other side is better. You know, it is more delicious.
Well, you mentioned Heidegger someplace in this book. Mm-hmm. I forget if it was an epigraph or something. And I know that he says poetry is necessity of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that we have to do something with that. We can't just lay it out there the way we think it. So let's hear what you do with that. Pat Gray.
One of the things I want to do in this book is combine the way we know things using the whole body, not just the intellect. And so that's what this poem is about. It's the incantation. Step onto the deck. Push off. This vessel is made of intelligence, yours and mine. The stuff we have whittled back to a poor imitation, to fragments measured on tests. Put back what the body knows. Return soul to bone. Wrap mind in its scarlet cloaked case. Feel ideas form. You have only to step aboard to shed your old life.
Another. You could just start on page one, as far as I'm concerned. Go right to the end.
I do want to read the poem Birth. It's about my son and what happened at school one day. Tulips blaze yellow in the vase as my son bursts in from school, his fifth grade science lesson glistening in his eyes. "We saw a fetus in a jar," he says. And his birthday was the same as mine. I could have been in that jar. He could have been standing there looking at me. On the table behind my son, a petal is missing from one of the tulips, leaving a thin glimpse of stamen, such as the openings we get sometimes. The one my son slipped through today, blooming.
She has received grants from the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities, and I believe she was awarded a small projects grant for poetry promotion, which I think is a beautiful thing to do, which is a service to poetry, because as well as creating it, we need to hoist it out a little bit.
That's true.
You know, put our shoulder to the wheel and let the next guy get a taste of it.
Absolutely. This poem is about the sixth day of creation, the day a man and a woman were created. However, I've taken an imaginary turn with the story. So,
what a surprise.
So see what you think. Male taken from female. He was torn from her thigh, that first man in Eden. Bone splintered skin formed into sinews, tendons of him, but she rose unharmed and walked through fields, sunlight running down her shoulders and hair like electricity. Even before the sixth day, her spirit lived, for her energy has always been. Wind moved with her over earth and fields. Trees dropped their succulents into her hands, each fruit carrying its own seed within. Small animals also rose up in this time for her touch. Her right hand stroked the mane of a black mare that shivered its pleasure beside her. The first being came from water. With each footfall, she felt the rough textured earth, the early surfaces of land. And even before he was formed, man lived within her, took shape in Eden to help her. When he sprang from her thigh, rolled over and stood, she brushed twigs from his hair, dirt from his legs, as if he were a large child in her care. Speechless, he would find words to praise her. Already, he felt the fierce longing to return to her steady certainty, squatted strength. So it was then, and is now. This story kept from you, a secret you have always known.
This is true, and it is just as it is, as she brushes the twigs from his hair. Just as it is. If our poetry, or if poetry is supposed to elevate values, I mean, that's not to be too academic, but it is said to elevate values. Mm-hmm. What is your contribution? I mean, what do you think you're doing?
Well, this particular poem wasn't really meant to be taken totally seriously. I'm not trying to attack the story that we all know about the Garden of Eden, but just to offer an imaginary take on it. And so for values, I think I wanted my poems to have the moral compass in a way, something that is not a moral lesson per se, but presents some ideas or facts in a way that our bodies can understand.
Well said. Very well said. How to direct thought without directing thought. Yeah, I really like what you just said. Patricia Gray. She has that soft southern accent who makes you think you're going to just hear something very nice, and then she comes out with a blockbuster, like something that she could tell Heidegger. Give us some more of that Southern accent.
Okay. I'm going to read the second two parts of Secrets at My Uncle's House.
He was big to you. He was important in your poetry.
You know, this uncle, to tell the truth, is a conglomeration of my uncles. I put them together to make this one. I really have been helped by my uncles. They're wonderful, wonderful people.
How many?
There are five uncles, two aunts on my father's side. And they all, since I was the first grandchild in the family, they all took an interest in me. So I would go along on trips or go visit them, and I'm really glad.
So you took all those little pieces of string and rolled it up into a big ball.
Right, exactly. This is part two of that poem about my uncle's house, where I was sitting in the living room looking around at all the odds and ends and feeling somehow protected by it, and knowing that that's where my interest in various things, the archaeology, the gargoyles, and so forth, came from. This is part two. For breakfast, Mrs. Bailey prepares your barley without exception, the thin milk a kind of liquid piece to be spooned into one's mouth. She does not know that your father made this table of dark cherry, tooled its legs, or that when the leaf is extended and pulled forward, it opens into other rooms, those of your childhood and mine, and further back, to grandfathers before us, to the one who came in 1780 to survey west of the Blue Ridge, but stayed that first winter on the mountain with a Senado woman and staked his claim. Our dark grandmother was not mentioned until you told the story. She lay her body against his in the bitter wind and rain. When spring came, she taught him what Europe forgot. Guiding his fingers with hers, she helped him make a bow. Part three. These are the instructions. To make a bow, choose a small tree, three hand spans in girth. Ask permission. If not given, move on. When you sense acceptance, begin with a flint knife. Make a groove in the trunk the width of your two fingers, and another groove six handspans above it. Cut out a long strip between them, and season the strip a full year. Carve into a graceful bow. Wipe gently with bear grease, and string with sinews of deer. Before the bow bends to your hand, or learns the strength of your pull, honor its beauty, the speed of the bear and deer, the skyward lift of the tree. No one will take it from you.
Did I hear right? When you accept acceptance, look at the tree. What is that line? She's teaching him.
Oh, you go and stand near the tree you wish to cut a strip from to make a bow, and you will know whether the tree is willing, and if the tree isn't willing, then you must move on.
Huh. And who was this woman?
She was an Indian woman, you know, American Indian woman, and we don't really know. This was from a story that I learned at a family reunion.
So you have been listening to these stories your whole life, and you've been making notes?
Well, some of them have come much later, after I've been grown and talked to relatives. Then I get told these odd stories that weren't really first told at the family reunions.
And some you fill in the edges.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh. Let's have another poem. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri talking to Patricia Gray, author of Rupture.
I want to read this poem called Flu, Spring Rain, and You. It's about an ex-husband, and in this case, it's my ex-husband. Lying in bed, flu bogged, I wonder what mean quirk of fate makes my body cry out for the muscle and contour of yours. 2 years after our divorce, and 1 year into my new love. I'm too weak for anything but need, and need you I do. Though you're in California, and I'm with someone new, the vines of our marriage are bound up in my veins like a virus, green and climbing, making my body crave comforts from a marriage that continues like a stump in the forest, dead, except for a few green sprigs, persistent at weakest moments in spring rain.
Universal story, I think many people have experienced, but maybe few don't have put words to it.
And people don't necessarily admit it if they feel that way. But I think, our minds work on one track and our bodies work on another. And things that our bodies need and want come to the fore when we're weak.
And they have memory. Our bodies hold memory.
Certainly do.
And that's what that poem's about. It's not about wanting to remarry this man.
Not at all.
It's just that such a true feeling. And I think that's what Billy Collins meant about you when he said to pick up this book is to hold the whole being of another, because you don't hold back the intimacy in the poem. Thank you for that.
Some people have said that my poems, my book, is fearless. And, I don't quite know what they mean. I don't quite understand. The best I can think of is that I sort of dig to find some truth in the situations and try to pull that up and see what it's about.
But Patricia, surely you know that you are saying some extremely personal things in some of these poems. We haven't heard the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, they take courage. I mean, we teach courage to writers. We don't teach language. And so you're exemplifying what we wish to teach writers. And that is the courage of your experience, the truth of your experience. And some of it is extremely personal. So why wouldn't that? I understand completely. I had that same feeling when I read that. I thought, wow, she's fearless. Those words. And you don't see it, Patricia.
No.
You don't see how your poetry is different from the average. And not that there's any average poetry, but I think yours goes a lot deeper than most women poets I know.
That's very interesting.
By many millimeters.
Complimentary, I think.
I think so. So let's go on with this expose.
Okay.
Now that's enough to scare you into stopping to write.
Well, I've read poems that are, here's one that's kind of an expose. I'll read this one. It's called Fear of Intelligence.
I like this one.
When you took yourself to school in the yellow, bright September sun, prickly as a whiskered kiss on your skin, and walked into the dark building filled with chalky smells and smudged boards and sat in a strange desk that swallowed your summer without even a burp. How was it then to be the smartest kid, the one in the first row who spelled nephew and xylophone? And later the new kid came like a cold blast from the northeast, full of precocity and promise, as the teachers whispered. How was it to be a little girl sitting on the stoop at recess, wanting to cut through the fog that kept you from saying to him, just because I'm rural doesn't mean I'm stupid, and to feel your classmates' anger crowd around your accurate answers, and to be smarter than the boys, and then to go to college and make a B on a test you should have aced, and doubt not the teacher, the question, the school, but yourself. And suppose you met someone smarter than you, who had not just better memory, math, music skills, facility with language, artistic talent, but all of these. And what if you married him? Your claim to importance disabled like a broken clamp. This man rising up before you expecting to be right, and years later to learn you were smarter. Your jaw like a revolver chamber hanging open, emptied, nothing to back it up. And now, too late, you're out of love and struggling with the elements of a puzzle, the last pieces always lost, but finally just to leave them there. Oh, September sun, come again. Bring the whiskered kiss, the long yellow days and tall shadows, pencils, lockers in the hall, students doing lessons. A rupture in your spirit seals as you drink mystery from the apple core. Turn loamy earth, smell burning leaves, anchored by the smallest thing it takes to teach you now to hold you here.
Oh, Patricia, that is absolutely your work of art. That is meditation and confrontation and realization, and it is an elegy. It is. And lyricism, that last stanza is just, oh, September sun, where it's not quite warm enough to warm us.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And we want to learn again what it's all about. Let go of our mistaken notions. And
you give that to us. We are all there with you. That's quite a feat.
I think little girls often, you know, early on, they're ahead of boys, but then later, they're not ahead of boys. In high school, they're not, you know. And so they have to adjust to all that. And I'm sure lots of girls have had experiences like this.
But what if you married him?
Right.
Then the stakes are a little higher.
Right.
It's a little bit, we have a double whammy going on here. So you have a structure, as Billy Collins talks about poetry, comparing it to jazz, and says you have to know the melody before you can do the discord underneath the notes. Before you can stand them on edge, in jazz, we have a melody, right? Chords, lines of chords. And then underneath that, something else is going on. So to write poetry, hopefully we know the melody first. And that means we've read other poets. We know what we come from, our ancestry. And what melody did you immerse yourself in?
This year it's been Walt Whitman especially. But the King James Version of the Bible, with its long anapestic lines, phrases and clauses coupled with and, you know, I think that that's in there in a deep place in me, those rhythms. And also, I love C.K. Williams' long lines. I find the long line lets more in. And so that's one of the things I've been
Know your sound, and I know the language sound of you, but I never think of you as having long lines.
Oh, well, they're not all long in here. Some of them are. But that's what I like to do.
You think that's your
what
voice?
What I'm learning to do. I have a new poem called Washington Days. It's up on InnisfreeJournal.com.
And very nice journal. I turned it on yesterday, and I made cucumber soup to the music. Have you heard the music?
Oh, no.
It's lovely. I didn't know your poem was there, but now I'll turn it on and read it.
Well, Washington Days is on there, and it has longer lines that go on and on.
That'll be interesting. We'll have a poem now, any line length at all.
Okay. I think I'll read a new sort of sugary poem. But I have a grandchild now, and I wanted to read this. It's called H, the letter H. Let her like a breath, or a pant, or the sound that wind heads on old maps must have made, blowing the ships toward the edge of the world. Just so strong is your breath, my boy, born beyond what nature would willingly allow, to look up at me, your 5-month eyes twinkling, mischief already there. Hi, Ryan. Hi, darling, I say. Your gleam grows brighter as you tuck your chin and smile. I almost don't hear the soft breaths you make. With a grin, hardly moving your mouth, your mom leans round my shoulder, whispering, "That's his hi." We tell you how wonderful you are, how clever to make that sound. A barely heard breath, the first salutation, a flute that awakens us to bring you into the circle of loved ones speaking and spoken to.
I think you have another grandchild now.
I do, a 2-month-old baby today. So
we'll have a whole new book about that, I'm certain. How do you like the poem Thin Air?
I like it.
That's on page 67. Did you actually take a glider and try to fly?
I did, uh-huh. My friend Dan and I went to North Carolina, where Wilbur and Orville Wright flew, and took hang gliding lessons. I just want to say that we have a lot of trust in the world to continue as we know it, to that people will stop at stoplights and stop signs, for instance, that things will go on. We trust other people in that way, and this poem is about trust as well. Thin Air. On the first day of flight, Orville Wright carried a small leather journal in his pocket to record wind speed. Over 200 miles, he wrote, and Wilbur's plane flying 852 feet in less than a minute. Today, Dan and I, carrying hang gliders on our backs, climb Jockey's Ridge, a huge dune near their site, wings heavy as a cumbersome pass teeter on my shoulder. When I try to run fast, my feet sink in sand, but then, almost magically, the wing weight lifts, and I glide over beach sand dotted with scrubs and gulls. Awed by the view, I steer too sharply and crash, denting the ground and my arm. Dan helps me up, but like Wilbur, I just want more time when flight lifts me out of the usual world into sumptuous suspension, where air can support a winged machine and nothing twists such a miracle off course or shoots down the trust it takes to hold it up.
You know, you haven't read a Washington poem, and I consider you such a Washington girl.
Oh.
You have Peace Street, and you have lawyers, and you have all kinds of things in your poems, bureaucracy and government workers. And so I always think that's your culture. You know, Patricia Gray.
Well, I was born in D.C.
Oh, mm-hmm. But you do come from something, and I think that is. So I was thinking, well, we should really include that.
Okay. It's called After the Argument. If I could capture the moon, I would bring it to your cottage hole, wrapped in lace underclothes, its pure light pooling on the sheets where we used to lie. In your sleep, dreaming of mandarins and ginger, you would turn in the light and smile, your cinnamon hair tangled in a silver smudged glow. And if I could hold all our days, pull back the curtains that slouch and slump on the floor to see ahead, I tell you honestly, I do not understand the love you give me. Is there nothing you would keep back? Part 2. I did not guess you'd come to me, red hair turning white, curly locks and beard, tall, big of belly, dripping from the sea. nor did I know you pulled its lower depths with you, that all your life you'd crashed within its storms. On land, your caring broke surface in finest seams, cool mists against the sunburnt heat. You came into my landlocked life like a Norwegian ship captain ridden by a fly. Your changing face, clouds across the sea force. In loving you, my shell broke loose. I was vulnerable as a sea creature at low tide and flourished there. So many times you swept us past my limits. I took your daughters to my heart. Your son's arrogance I forgave. I had such hunger for your taste. 3. Now, at day's end, driving down K Street toward a moon that squats hugely on the horizon, sweet moon of warm butter, watching me approach as if inviting my car to arc from street to sky, to cross over the distance and wreckage between us. I can almost hear the song you sang. All I need is the air that I breathe and to love you. And hearing hope, there is a way. Contagion. Pulling to the self that which destroys, wiping up the simplest viral start with bare hands, the young blondes and brunettes in the 1930s photo kneel in house dresses to clean the marble steps of the Library of Congress, all of them slim and maternal, so close to the dirt, wiping the gray fouled stone this way and that by hand with large soft cloths. I wish I could walk up those stairs, cleaned by women in flower dresses, wiped with their hands, but today masked workers bring loud machines and bristled polishers, and women no longer kneel for such work. Nor would I want them to, nor would I like to. Yet today, something in me wishes for them, for my foot to touch the cleanliness of that labor.
The voice of Patricia Gray. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. This Witter Binner series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art, and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. You can hear this series on www.loc.gov/poetry. We wish to thank the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.